Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to JC.
Hello, everybody. My name is JC, and I am an alcoholic. And congratulations to all the token takers and the newcomers. My sobriety date is April 19th, 1992. And I'm forever grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for that date. I'm a real alcoholic. And what I mean by that is that I'm not some little weekend party boy. I'm not somebody that drank once in a while and had a few bad trips or got just a DUI and had a bad night or anything. I am a real alcoholic as described in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I could not get sober on my own. And whenever I drank, I could not stop drinking. It was uncontrollable drinking. And that started right from the beginning. A lot of people take a long time to get to that point. I started that way. Anyway, I'm not from California. I'm from Texas. And all right. And I grew up a little country boy out in East Texas, and just a dumb kid, and didn't know shit from shinola. But I had an alcoholic home. Am I talking too loud? Yeah. My father died early on, and I don't think he was an alcoholic, and my mother wasn't an alcoholic, but I had a lot of alcoholics in the family, uncles and stuff. But she remarried. She married my stepfather was an alcoholic, so I saw a lot of alcoholism growing up, and I saw the ugly side of it, and I did not want anything to do with alcohol, because there was always a lot of fights, a lot of drunkenness, and a lot of nasty stuff, broken promises, all the stuff that comes with living in an alcoholic home. And I never even thought I had any problems when I was a kid. I think I was slightly autistic or something. I just wasn't aware of what was going on. I wasn't aware that I had bad feelings. I wasn't aware that I felt had low self-esteem or anything like that. And when I was about 12, we moved out of the country, and I was just a country boy. I hunted and fished and camped and canoed and did all that kind of stuff in those bayous in East Texas, and I loved it out there. And we moved to the big city of Houston, Texas, fourth largest city in the country, and I was thrown into a whole different cultural environment, and right away I hooked up with the bad kids because I was just kind of a wild kid, and started getting in trouble, and then I got straightened out, and all that before 13 years old. And somewhere around 13 years old, I had my first drink when I was about 5 or 6 years old. Some friends of the family stayed over for a wild party with my stepfather and mother and all that. And there was a bunch of bottles in the morning, and they told us to clean them out. And some of the other kids that were a little bit older, they said, "Hey, let's drink the bottom of the bottle." So I said, "Okay." I'm like 6, 8 years old, and I grabbed one of the bottles and turned it up. And it was one of those beer bottles that had a cigarette butt in it. I didn't like the taste of beer back then. The next time I had a drink I was probably about 13 years old, and my sister was dating a cowboy, and we ended up out at this kind of like a, I don't know what you'd call it, a little drunken barbecue thing, you know, and they had the big red cups that go with the keg, and we drank a bunch of those, and they put me on a motorcycle, and I wrecked the motorcycle, and it was just a mess. And I didn't drink again for a year, and I didn't really think much about it. I was still kind of into my fishing and hunting and that kind of stuff and camping. I was in the Boy Scouts. I joined the Boy Scouts when I moved to Houston because they were the only people I knew that would like to canoe and camp and hike and hunt and do all that kind of stuff that I like to do. So I was a pretty good kid. And somewhere around 14, things went south for me. Me and that stepfather were really butting heads, and the violence at the home was bad, and I just got a real bad chip on my shoulder, and I just hooked up with the bad boys again and started getting in trouble. And one of the first things I did was one night they said, "Do you want a drink?" And I said, "Sure." And I was 14, and I decided from the time I was a little kid that I was never going to drink, you know. And I'd already broke that promise once, and now I was just ready to jump in. I was all in. And we got some old guy to buy some beer. He probably was at least 21 or 22. And we jumped the fence of a junkyard and went back there, and we got drunk. And that night, I got arrested. I got into a fight. I had a blackout. You just name it. I got home. The cops brought me home. They beat me up, too, because they thought I was one of the guys that had broke into a factory that night that was out there in the where we lived. And my mother put me on restriction, and my stepfather got the belt on me, you know. And it was a brutal night. And I woke up the next morning and called my best friend and told him I couldn't wait to do that again. You know. Because something happened. And what happened was, like I told you before, I had no idea how I really felt. I had no idea about my feelings. I didn't understand anything. I was just an angry kid. And when I took that first beer, I probably got about halfway through, and that little buzz started coming on, you know. And then I got to another beer, and the buzz started really coming on. I had feelings that I'd never, ever felt before. I'd never felt that way before. And suddenly I felt great. And I went from like a 2 to a 10 right away. I didn't know there was such a thing as a 10. And I didn't know that I was a 2. But the next morning when I woke up, I felt like a 2. I felt like my normal self, and I was like a 1 or a 2, you know. And I thought, and I knew right away I wanted to be a 10. And there was a quick way to be a 10, and that was getting the booze again. And that's why I loved it right from the very beginning. And so from that day on, I knew that I'd found this wonderful beverage, this magical elixir of life, and that I wanted to be involved in that from then on. That was my new best friend. And it was such a new best friend, I started losing other friends because of it. Because people that didn't drink like I wanted to drink, I didn't want to hang around with them. Early on after that, a couple weeks, where we lived, we all got our driver's license real young. We got them at 15. We had these working driver's license one of my friends came over one day after school with his mother's car, and we were all like 15. We got some guys to buy us a six-pack, and we had a six-pack between three of us, and I drank my two beers real quick, and they were like still sipping on the very first one, and I started wanting their beer. You know, and they didn't want to give me their beer. And they started saying something about how I drank and why did I drink so fast and what's wrong with me. And I never drank with them again. I never wanted to be with them again. I never wanted to, because I was saying, let's go back and get another six pack. Well, they didn't want to get another six pack. They were happy with that. They were normal drinkers. And I knew right then that I would never drink unless I could start drinking, unless I could get all I could want. Because when that stuff crossed my lips, the main thing that happened was more. I wanted more, you know. And as long as I had beer in my hand and was drinking, because once I started drinking, I had a beer in my hand the whole time. A beer or drink, whatever. And I've never stopped drinking. And if I didn't have it, I went crazy. That's all I was thinking about. I didn't have to think about it if I had it on me. And that's how it started progressing right from the beginning. And you know, like I said, I was a really wild kid. I was a very angry kid, a very aggressive kid. And you add alcohol to that and testosterone to that, and I started getting in trouble. And I quit school very young, high school, and I started getting kicked out of high school. Then I started, then I just ultimately just quit. And it just went south from there. And this was at a time there was a lot of that other stuff, and I got involved in everything. There was nothing out there that I wouldn't do. There was no other drugs out there that I wouldn't do. So I did everything, and I got involved in it at the deepest levels, and just went head first into it. And by the time I was 17, I already had quite a record, and I started going through the Texas prison farm system. That's just the work system. If any of y'all are familiar with Cool Hand Luke, it's just like Cool Hand Luke, you know. And in and out of that, and by the time I was 18, I was in a shotgun wedding because an underage girl ran away from home, moved in with me, and her father came over with her big old football player brother, and they were ready to do me up for a statutory rape, they called it. And I told them how much I loved her, and they welcomed me to the family, that I was their new son-in-law. We got married, and that was a marriage from hell. And that was my first marriage. at 18. And I was divorced by 21, and basically it was over after 6 months, though, to tell you the truth. And on and off, on and off. And but I was, you know, I liked her a lot, but I liked all of her friends too. I liked everybody else. So, and I was fine when I wasn't drinking, but put anything in me, and you know, I had no morals whatsoever. And from there, you know, I. By the time I hit 21, you know, I was all in on everything. Like, you know, if you could shoot it, smoke it, swallow it, snort it, drink it, I did it. And I was in trouble constantly with the law. I was in trouble constantly with everybody that I knew. My whole family had pretty much disowned me. The state had put me in 2 treatment centers by then, drug treatment centers by 21. And I'd been stabbed in the heart, been just a lot of violence. Almost all my friends were dead or in jail or in prison for life, or they were just crazy and crippled up too. You know, it was just a mess. It was a mess. I was like the last guy standing at 21. And at that point, I wanted something else. I didn't want this life that I had. And I wanted to get off of all the drugs, and I wanted to learn how to drink like a gentleman. And I'd always drank like a pig. I drank to get drunk. That was the only way I knew how to drink. And I decided I was going to learn how to drink normally. Because there had been many, many times during my drinking career, that like 6 or 7 years by this point, where I had said I was only going to have 1 or 2. There had many, many times where I had decided I was only going to have 1 or 2, but as soon as I drank it, it was on. I couldn't stop. We'd go to a bar after work or something, you know, and they'd say, let's stop by the bar and get a couple, you know. And we'd have a couple, and they're all ready to go home to their wives, girlfriends, whatever, go to school, whatever they had to do. I was staying in the bar, and I didn't leave the bar till 2 o'clock, so they made me. And then I was looking for after-hours places or getting into all that other stuff. So that was just the way it was. So, but at 21, 22, 22 years old, actually, I decided I was going to... I was going to learn how to drink normally and get off all the hard stuff and start trying to change my life. I tried to join the military. It was the middle of the Vietnam War. They wouldn't even let me in the military because of my record. But they said if I could stay clean for X amount of time, they would consider me. It took 2 years to get in the military and during that time. You know, so I started experimenting. I thought my mom had told me since I was a little kid that my stepfather was an alcoholic, and what he needed, his problem was he needed to learn how to control his drinking. He needed how to learn how to control his drink, drink slower, this kind of thing. And so I thought that to be a controlled drinker, that's what I needed to do. I always told him, you know, I'd laugh and say, oh yeah, I'm alcoholic. I thought that just meant that I drank too much and drank out of control. That's all I thought it was, you know. So I didn't think of it in the AA way that I learned many years later. So I assumed that all I needed to do was learn how to control my drinking. I assumed it was a willpower thing, that, you know, I just have to... So I started trying to do that. But every time, that phenomenon of craving, that's what I heard when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. If a real alcoholic takes so much as a little drink of alcohol, then that switch goes on, and that phenomenon of craving hits, and he cannot control how much he drinks afterwards. And that always happened to me. And it happened to me with all that other stuff too. And some of that stuff would make it where I could just, you know, nurse a drink all day long. Some of it helped me drink way more at the same time, you know. But the alcohol itself was always like that. Well, I started trying to experiment to be a controlled drinker, and I kept getting drunk. I kept getting drunk. I tried that experiment of the first drink, and I tried to do a lot of other things. Like we read chapter 3 tonight from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It tells you all these different things that you do that the alcoholic does to try to control his drinking, you know. And I tried all these kind of things, and I could not control my drinking once I took that drink, and I couldn't understand that. I started thinking there was something wrong with me, because I knew lots of people that could drink just a couple here or there. Sometimes they might drink 2, sometimes they might drink six, sometimes they might just get drunk if they wanted to, and I wanted to be like that. I wanted to be able to not drink. If I didn't want to drink, if I wanted to have a couple, I wanted to have a couple. If I wanted to have a six pack, I'd have a six pack. If I wanted to get totally shit-faced, I'd go get totally shit-faced. I wanted to have that choice. I wanted to be in control of that, and I wasn't in control of that. Every time I took a drink, I was drunk. And when I drank, you know, my old self would pop up. I'd return to form and cause a lot of problems. And ultimately, I got in the Navy. And one of the reasons I wanted to get in the Navy was I wanted to get off those streets of Houston, get away from the crowds that I knew, because no matter where I went, I'd see people that I knew, and it just drug me down. It was real easy to, you know, I would say I wasn't going to drink, and somebody could say, well, you won't have one beer? And I'd go, no, oh, come on, okay, you know, and then be off again, you know, and they'd offer me this other stuff. So I couldn't really say no too much out there. So ultimately, I got in the Navy, which was very good for me, because I got some discipline for the first time in about eight years, first time I had any discipline whatsoever in my life. And I stayed in the Navy for 4 years. And the Navy was very, very good for me because I had long periods of where I didn't drink or smoke pot or do anything else. But every time we went to port, if we were overseas, if we'd been out at sea for 90 days, I'd be telling everybody, man, I'm feeling great, man. I hadn't drank in 90 days, feeling good, man, getting back in shape and everything. We'd hit port, and it was on again. All the trouble I got into in the military was because I drank too much. And I had a couple of little drug issues, because I was a hard worker in the military, and when I was sober, I was an asset to those around me that they protected me when I got in trouble. So I made it through the military. I got an honorable discharge, which was amazing. And then I moved back to, I got married right there at the end of my Navy stint. And my drinking buddy, she got pregnant. I'm not sure how she did that, but we had a kid and we got out and drove back to Houston and stayed drunk for a solid 45 days. And I got back to Houston. I said, I'm going to quit drinking. I'm going to quit drinking for a year. And I quit at midnight on New Year's Eve and started back midnight the following New Year's Eve. I stayed sober for a whole year off alcohol. But I did a lot of other stuff. And we had another kid. And I liked her friends too. And the marriage ended. And it ended with her pointing a shotgun at me. I'm going to blow my head off. And I was going, what did I do? But what did I do wrong? You know. But that was the story of my life. And so now I'm going to, you know, as a high school dropout, I got a GED when I was in the military, and I always felt bad because I was a high school dropout, you know, and I always felt kind of dumb and less than about that, you know, and so people told me, hey, you're a smart guy, you know, wish you wouldn't act so dumb, though. So I started trying to go to college. When you're caught in the grip of alcoholism and you're already getting a little bit older in age, it's really difficult to go to college. For me, it was really difficult because I'd go to work all day. I'd start a little business, and I had a meat and seafood business down in Houston, Texas, and I would start drinking at some point during the day, and then I remember I had to go to school, and I'd show up at school drunk out of my mind. And have you ever been in a small room, you know, and somebody walks in that smells like a brewery, and the whole room smells like a brewery? And that's what I do on a regular basis. And so I was really struggling. And I met W3, and we got married. And she was a normal drinker. She's the first normal drinker that I ever met around. She was the type of girl that, you know, if she had about half a beer, she'd go, oh, I don't like this. It's making my head fuzzy. And here, I'll take it. And anyway, after 2 years with me, when I first met her, I told her, she said, you drink a lot. I said, I've never been drunk a day in my life. And she bought it. She bought it. And I tried not to be drunk to her. And then one day after she knew me for 6 months, I got really, really wasted. And I showed up at her house with a strange kitten. And I don't even know what I was doing with it, you know. But I thought it would cover up my drinking. And after, on October 17th, 1984, I came home late. I'd been doing a lot of drugs. I was very drunk. I had a lot of stuff in my truck. I was supposed to go on to work that day. I didn't really go to work. I went by and saw some friends, and we ended up getting wasted all day. And I, actually it was October 16th, 1984, and I show up at the at my house. We had a little townhouse, and my wife and her in-laws were there, and they just flipped on me. And she told me that night, she said, "You're going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, or I'm out of here." And she had talked to some Al-Anon. And I don't know if you ever hooked up with somebody and they're an army and they've talked and you're not, and they've talked to an Al-Anon, you're in trouble. And I was in trouble that night, and I said, "Sure, I'll go to Alcoholics Anonymous." I'd been trying to control my drinking all these years and hadn't been successful. I'd really wanted to control my drinking all these years. Now, there's plenty of times I wanted to get really, really shit-faced, and I did. I was always successful at that when I decided to do that. But I was always unsuccessful at trying to just drink normally, have a couple of drinks, or even not drink at all. And so I said, "Okay, I'll go." But the next day, I came home from work. I went to work the next day, came home that day, and I hoped she had forgotten about it. She didn't forget about it. And she told me to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, or else, you know. And she talked to more Al-Anons, and she was really geared up, man. She's already well on her way to a black belt. So I went to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time on October 17th, 1984, in Houston, Texas, at the Gulf Coast Lawn Club, and it was a wonderful experience. I absolutely loved it. I walked in there, and a whole bunch of people were smiling and laughing. They look at me and go, "Oh, you must be JC." And they knew me. They knew I was a newcomer right away. I couldn't understand that. They gave me a big book. I still have that big book. I never read it back then, I'd have a different sobriety date if I did. But if I read it and practiced it, maybe. But I liked AA. Here were people that were controlling their drinking. Here were people that were sober. Here were people that were telling my story. They'd done all the stuff that I had done. And I was just like thrilled to be around them. I'd never met people, and they were telling me stuff about the first drink. "Don't take that first drink. It's the first drink that's killing you. You know, it's not the boost that's killing you. It's the engine that's killing you, you know?" And they started telling me these little common sense things. I said, "Oh, that's good." And I liked the meetings because people were sitting in the meetings bullshitting and doing all this stuff. And I liked it, you know, and they were talking drunk stuff, you know, and so I enjoyed it a lot. But I didn't care about, you know, some of them mentioned things like the 12 steps. I didn't really care about that, you know, there was one step I liked. It was called the 13th step. I thought that was kind of nice, but they were talking about reading the big book. I didn't do that. They were talking about getting a sponsor, you know, this kind of stuff. And I thought that was really very, that was for really bad alcoholics. That wasn't for me. But I went to meetings a lot, and I stayed sober for almost about five and a half years. And then during that time, I moved to California. I started going back to school, and I was able to go to school. I went to Houston Community College, then I went to University of Houston, got a 4-year degree over there. Then I moved out here and got into a graduate school down in San Diego, went to school there. I was doing great. But I wasn't doing the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And you know, if you sober up a horse thief and nothing changes, what you have is a sober horse thief. I mean, if you sober up a drunken horse thief, and nothing else changes, what you have is a sober horse thief. And that was like me. I was a drunken horse thief who had sobered up, and now I was a sober horse thief. I hadn't changed on the inside. Nothing had changed really up here. Nothing had changed here. I just wasn't drinking. And after 5.5 years, I was thirsty, and I was a miserable person to be around. You know, I'm working all the time. I'm going to school all the time. You know, I think I'm a hot shot now. You know, I'm not that dumb little kid anymore. Now I think I'm hip, slick, and cool. And my wife just W3 just was sick of me, so she found H2. Husband number two, while she was still married to me, you know. So now the tables are all turned. I really don't like that, you know. And when I moved to California, I didn't really hook up in California. California AA was doing it all wrong, you know. down in Texas, you know, they were used to me. They were used to that, you know, I didn't really have a sponsor. I didn't really read the book. I didn't do any of that stuff. They were kind of like used to me. Oh, that's him. You know, but when I moved to California and San Diego, they were kind of like, you know, where I moved, a little town named Ramona up in the foothills of outside of San Diego, in a little cowboy town. And they were like really into the big book and all that stuff. And they kind of looked down on me. They didn't know me, you know, they didn't know me from Jack. And I got a resentment to all them. So I quit going to AA. And now I don't have AA, you know, I don't have the steps, nothing's changed, and I'm a sober horse thief. I'm starting to want to steal horses. And so when the shit really hit the fan with me and the wife, I decided right then and there that I was going to start drinking again, and that now it was going to be completely different, because I'm not the dumb little high school dropout redneck country boy from Texas. Now, I've got class. I'm going to drink like a gentleman. And there's a line in the big book that says, you know, if you can drink like a gentleman, we'll take our hats off to him. And I was thinking, I'll make those guys take their hats off to me, you know. And that's how my egotistical mind was running, you know. And I was back in full relapse mode. I was ready. And I hit it running. And one of the things that I said that whole 5.5 years I was sober, I said, you know, I would never drink and drive again if I ever drank again. Because I learned so much about DUIs and all this kind of stuff that I'm not gonna do that. And one of my good friends in AA down there, he relapsed after a number of years. And the first night he relapsed, he wiped out a whole family, killed 4 kids and the mother, you know, on a relapse, just after like a couple of six packs, you know. And I was thinking, you know, I'll never drink and drive. But within weeks, I was drinking and driving. Because it was a 45-minute drive from my workplace to my home. Once I started drinking, I couldn't drive. I couldn't get off work and drive that far without a drink. And at first, I'd buy one beer for the ride. Well, man, a beer lasts me about 5 minutes, that first one. I can sip on them after I've had about 15. But those first ones, I'm slamming them down hard and fast. And so I drive that one. Well, then I'm having to stop at another store, you know. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm only going to have two on the way home. But pretty soon, I'm really, you know, buying single beers is like really stupid, you know, because they're very expensive that way. You know, it's much cheaper by the six-pack, you know. So it was very quickly I drank a six-pack in that 45-minute drive, you know. And then pretty soon, I don't even want to go home. I got a six-pack in me. I'm ready to go out now, you know. So, you know, we're going to extend. And after about 3 or 4 weeks of drinking, I found myself on the side of the road at 3 a.m. in the morning. And I didn't know how I got there. I didn't know where I was. And I'm trying to recall what happened that night. It's all fuzzy. Last thing I remember, I was drinking like a gentleman someplace. And I wake up like a pig somewhere on the side of the road, you know, drunk and hungover. I thought, geez, what happened? You know, well, we're going to have to get a better try at this, you know. But anyway, it didn't work. It didn't work. I went on that little drink that started after 5.5 years sober lasted 9 months. I drank around the clock, morning, noon, and night, all the time. I could not stop drinking. I was using all that other stuff. And I went back right to old forms, started doing all kinds of other stuff, getting involved with all kinds of characters, trouble left and right. Pretty soon I started getting in legal troubles, and in no time I had two by the end of that 9 months, I had two DUIs. And the last DUI I had, I was been drinking since like 6 in the morning. It was like 3 a.m. the following morning. I've been doing other stuff, and I had an open Jeep, and I pulled over on an inside medium on the highway to adjust my radio at 3 a.m., and nothing looks like a drunk guy worse than that, you know. And the cops pulled me over. They took me into downtown San Diego drunk tank, and I'm sitting in there, and I already got a DUI just a few weeks before. And I'm sitting there going, man, this is done. I'm getting a handle on this. This is like bad. Now I've lost my career. The career that I just finished working 5.5 years for in school, that's gone. And now my license is gone. And you know, I'm not going to be able to drive. I'm not going to be able to work in the field that I was trained in. I'm not going to be able to, you know, it was all a nightmare. I was thinking, man, it's over. I'm done. And I said that all night long. And I probably had a come to Jesus moment in there too. I don't remember. But, you know, I was pulling out all the stops, you know. And, got out at 8 o'clock in the morning, They had my Jeep a couple blocks away. Walked over to where my Jeep was, got in my Jeep. It was an open-air Jeep, just a little bikini top, open on the sides. It's 8 o'clock in the morning, middle of the week, like a Tuesday or Wednesday. I get in that Jeep, and I'm swearing to myself I'm not going to drink. I see a 7-Eleven, and I couldn't stop fast enough into that 7-Eleven. There was nothing I needed more at that moment than a drink. I needed a drink more than anything. I had a 45-minute drive on the main highway, 15, exiting out of San Diego to go to North County, San Diego. 45-minute drive in an open Jeep at rush hour traffic, and I had to have two beers for the way. I had two tall boys on the way home in paper bags, and nothing looks more like you're drinking alcohol than some large paper bag, tall boy size. And I could have got another DUI right then, but I couldn't make it, you know. And so I was out of control now. I was completely out of control. And didn't matter what I said to myself, I drank. You know, if I said I wasn't going to drink, I was going to drink. If I said I was only going to have two, I was going to end up getting drunk. You know, if I said I was going to get drunk, I was definitely going to get drunk. You know, so it didn't matter. You know, I got drunk. That's what I was. I was an alcoholic, you know. And so I ended up going back into AA. Called up an AA friend. My last drink, sitting on the floor, drinking hot vodka, swallowing Vicodin, smoking pot, calling an AA buddy, complaining about it. Got into AA, but I still wouldn't do what was suggested around here. You know, I went back to AA, and it took me another year. I never drank again, but I wouldn't stop the other funny stuff, you know. So nothing changed, and I was miserable after a year. And oh God, I was thirsty. I wanted to drink more than anything. And finally, on April 18th, 1992, I went to a big AA convention down south, and something happened that night. I don't know what it was. My girlfriend had left me, and I knew she was at that AA dance. In my mind, she was at the AA dance trying to get guys, and you know, I showed up there, you know, and I was wasted, and there was like 2,500 sober people there. I don't remember anything that happened, but the next morning I went home. I flushed everything down. I went to a meeting the next morning and walked into that AA meeting and said, and just tears run down my eyes. I said, I want help. I need help. I'd never asked for help a day in my life. Never. I wasn't the type of guy that was ever going to ask for help. I walked in asking for help, man. AA people came and got me, put their arms around me. They took me out to breakfast after the meeting. One crazy dude gave me his motorcycle to drive for the day. And I don't know what's wrong with that guy. But I would have never done that. I wouldn't do that today. But I did return it to him in good shape, that was the beginning of my trip. I got a guy to sponsor me. I'd had sponsors. Probably over the last, I'd pick different sponsors, but I wouldn't ever do anything they said. And if they told me something I didn't like, I'd get rid of them. You know, I wasn't going to do anything. And I got me a guy that I knew could see right through me, that he knew I was full of shit, that he knew that I was just a horse thief, you know, a liar, cheat, and a thief, that I was selfish, self-centered, and self-seeking. And he understood, you know, that I was childish and immature and grandiose. You know, he knew what kind of piece of shit I was of a person, no character whatsoever. You know, there was nothing that came out of my mouth could you trust, you know, and I couldn't trust anything that came out of my mouth. And he knew I was that type of guy. And he after practically begging this dude to sponsor me, he said, okay, I'll do it. He says, but you got to allow me to tell you the truth. And that didn't sound good at all, let me tell you. And he says, I'm going to tell you a lot of stuff that's going to hurt a lot. And he said, and you won't like it, but I'm not telling you anything trying to hurt you. That's not the point. The point is to get you the truth. Because if you know the truth can set you free. Because as long as you're living in a lie, you can't be free. And that's what my whole life was, illusion, a delusion. And I was stuck in obsessions of the mind that were controlling me and making me drink all the time and get drunk all the time. And I couldn't realize it. He explained to me the insanity of alcoholism. The insanity wasn't all the crazy crap I was doing. It wasn't all the trouble I did. It wasn't all the ex-wives, the affairs, the crazy drug things, all the going to prison. That wasn't the crazy stuff. The crazy stuff was that I kept picking it back up despite everything. Despite everything that happened, I kept picking it up thinking that it was going to be different this time. I've done that crazy experiment thousands and thousands of times. You know, and at some point I understood that I couldn't even handle the first drink, but I could not stop from taking that first drink. I had something happen in my mind that made me where I had no effective mental defense against the first drink. No matter what I wanted to avoid, no matter how bad I wanted to avoid that first drink, I couldn't avoid it. And that's what the book tells us. We have, at certain times, the alcoholic has no effective mental defense against the first drink. His defense must come from a higher power. We have these mental blank spots right around taking that drink that we'll just grab that drink and do it. And we'll grab those drugs and do it. And that's what it meant by powerless. And that's what it meant by, that's what step one, I'm powerless over alcohol. That was my, you know, I couldn't tell you when I was going to get drunk because I had no defense against the first drink. And once I took that first drink, just one drink, I was off and running. Yeah, and then it said the step two, came to believe that a power greater than us could restore us to sanity. That's the sanity, to give me the ability to have an effective mental defense against the first drink. Because if you never took the first drink, it wouldn't make a difference. You know, but I couldn't quit taking the first drink. So I was stuck. I was a real alcoholic. I didn't want to be a real alcoholic. You know, I wanted to be that guy that just needed to learn how to control and enjoy his drinking. That was my great obsession. Somehow, someday, some way, I was going to control and enjoy my drinking. And despite everything that you guys in AA would tell me, you know, I would continue experimenting, trying to take, you know, ways to take that first drink, ways to do it. And because I didn't want to be a real alcoholic. That opening line of chapter 3 says, most of us are unwilling to admit we're real alcoholics. Most of us are unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. That's the opening line of chapter 3 that was read tonight. And so we know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. And that was me. I had to understand that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. I wasn't going to ever recover the ability to safely take a drink again, you know. So I had to do this real program. I wasn't going to do the fake program that I did when I first came in, going to meetings, sitting around, talking shit, you know, trying to be cool. You know, I'm like the most uncool guy there is, man. I'm like uncool. I'm like Mr. Uncool, you know. And I'm the opposite. So, I wanted sobriety. I'd already thrown my whole life away. I'd thrown my whole life away. Threw families away, kids away, jobs away, mother away, you know, sisters, brothers, cousins, all my friends. I'd thrown everything away behind alcohol. So once I was able to look at that and see, I have thrown my whole life away. Am I willing to completely give my life now to this program, to recovery? Because that's what it's going to take. And that's what they said in chapter 5, you know, that we had to completely give ourselves to this simple program. That's what I had to do. I had to come in all in, just like I was all in on all this other stuff. I had to come all in, because otherwise it wasn't going to work. You know, half measures avail you nothing. Half measures around AA, if you're a real alcoholic, half measures around AA don't give you 25%. They don't give you 50%. They don't give you 10%. They don't give you 75%. They give you nothing, because you'll have a period of recovery followed by a worse relapse. That's the damn truth. And I found that out, and I would never want to believe that. And it also said over any period of time, a real alcoholic gets worse, never better. His ability to control his alcohol gets worse. And that's what I found when I had that relapse. I took that drink in 9 months. Spent 9 months of straight drinking, and then I was nailed to the wall, you know. So I had to accept that that's what I really was. And being a real alcoholic has been the greatest blessing of my life, to find this out, because now I know I'm not crazy. You know, I've been restored to sanity. I have a power greater than myself that operates in my life today, a living, loving creator that I have a personal relationship with that protects me from drinking and helps guide me in all kinds of things today. I didn't have that before. I didn't even think that was believable. And all I had to do is a few simple steps, just a few simple steps that I was taught around here to do. Just very simple stuff. If it was complicated, I would have already screwed it up. But it's very simple stuff, you know. 12 little steps and, you know, and it's been a beautiful, beautiful journey. I would never want to go back to what I had before. And I thought, you know, there was a time when alcohol and all that other stuff was just like so much fun. But there was these consequences. And then they started getting more and more consequences and less fun. And toward the end, alcohol was just a necessity. It was no longer a luxury. It was no longer fun. It was just pure necessity. I had to stay drunk all the time. No matter what I chose, when I woke up, I ended up getting drunk and stoned and everything else. And, you know, I haven't had to do that in over 24 years now. 24 years in one day, you know, and that's an absolutely amazing thing. and I put Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's going to meetings, getting a sponsor. That's not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the steps that are the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. A sponsor will help you go through it, and the meetings are a lot of fun, a lot of fellowship. It's where we get to carry the message. We have to carry this message, you know. But today, you know, I have a life that I only dreamed of, you know, because what happened was I discovered me. I never knew who I was. I was still, you know, that little 2 that became a 10 when he was drunk. That guy was a 0 by the time he finally got to AA, you know. Life wasn't worth living at all, you know. I'd lost everything, and it just got worse. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, man, I wake up in the morning feeling like the luckiest guy in the world. And if you feel like that too, that's great. I applaud that, because that's how we get to feel around here. When you have a great relationship with a power greater than yourself, which I choose to call God, that can help you walk through anything. I'm telling you, if these people around in this room, like Gary over here with 40 something years, and other people in here, Freeman with 20 something, Don with almost 30 years, all these people with a long period of sobriety, they didn't get that way because everything went smooth. Anthony over there with a whole bunch of years, they went that way because they had a power greater than themselves operating their life, which gave them the strength to walk through anything. I've had some of the worst things that ever happened in my life happened since I've been sober. And I'm not going to go into a long list of that, but it's a big list. You know, and I've been able to walk through everything and not even have to want to drink. You know, it's a beautiful thing. I put Alcoholics Anonymous in the program of recovery, and I don't separate that from my God. I put that number one in my life. That's number one in my life. And when I put sobriety number one in my life, I get to treat the rest of my life first class. Thank you very much.